Yes, after 10 weeks of the 14-week training cycle, we heard that the ASTP was being folded up and that most of the people would be transferred to other active military units, and of course we were transferred, we found, to the infantry, to an infantry division, the 100th Infantry Division. As I indicated, that I don't know what I said, but the other side had taken cover, did you not, about the loss of individuality. Okay, well, it was a very chastening, it was a very educational experience, because we heard everybody's going to transfer to the 100th Infantry Division. You still think of yourself as an individual. You go down to the list of people being transferred, you expect to see you're going to be treated differently, and there you are, one line among 500 other people down there. It's a very destructive of the individuality concept. Certainly it was a very disheartening thing, obviously. But in any event, that's life. And so we went to the 100th Infantry Division in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the 399th Infantry Regiment. And we continued training infantry there. And then just about the time we finished the infantry basic training, we found that a lot of people had been transferred from these defunct ASTP units, either in the training base or from the training phase, rather, or from the university phase. A lot of them were being transferred out to combat engineer battalions all over the country, either in Oklahoma or, as it turned out for us, at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Dr. Denman, were they the only ones being transferred?
It seemed like at that particular point. I don't know what the rationale of the military was. Maybe they figured these guys were brighter than dog faces that were just carrying, just good for carrying rifles and being chewed up. So military, you can't quite understand why they do things. Sometimes it makes some sense, but that's rather rare. In any event, we were sent down to these combat engineer battalions that were just being formed. We couldn't figure out why they were being formed. We all made jokes that this was since about the time when the Allied forces were in Western Germany. This was in Fort Jackson, which is outside of Columbia, South Carolina. And we made jokes that they were forming these battalions, these independent battalions, to cross the Rhine. And as it turned out, indeed, this is probably what they had in mind. Of course, the Remagen Bridge made things a little different than that regard. Anyway, the idea also, I guess, for taking these ASTP types is they also were possibly more educable, maybe they were leaders, and we would be the cadre for forming these combat engineer battalions. And we didn't have any rank, but we were going to be the corporals and the sergeants, if we could make it, and train these people who came in from the conscription to become combat engineers. We didn't know anything about it ourselves, but then you learn as you went along. Well, this was a strange mix of people, because the people they sent us were mostly oil field roustabouts from Oklahoma, and a few Indians from there, too. And this is a strange bunch of roughnecks, and you're all a bunch of would-be quondam college types, you know. And we were going to be the leadership here. Boy, that was a bit of a catastrophe as time went on. But it was a very roughneck bunch of people, and of course the Indians are another story altogether. But I remember one time we were giving a class in the assembly and disassembly of the Thompson submachine gun. And one of the Okies said, "Oh, I can do that with my eyes shut." We said, "All right, wise eyes, blindfold, you're going to do it." And darn if he didn't take it apart and put it back together again. And we said, McKee, where'd you learn how to do this? "Oh, we used to run liquor down from Arkansas. We would take the gun apart, we went, drove up, drove back the liquor, and we put the machine gun back together again on the way down in the dark. I could do this any time, I shut." Pretty good. So I mean, this is the kind of people we had that we were supposed to be
training,
which was, didn't last for as long. So it was a very strange mixture of people. Anyway, we sort of endured that. I didn't think much of it. People had a pretty arrogant, I guess, kid, these people. But they could handle rigging, they could handle 2x4s, they could rustle things around. So it was a very interesting, it was a very educational experience. Then there were the Indians. The Indians were, never, who had ever seen an Indian? Nice Jewish boy from Logan. Never saw an Indian before in my life. And it wasn't like in the movies. And they were funny, but the one thing about them, they could not hold liquor. None of them could hold liquor. And I remember Chief Knockwater, Nakwadi, we called him Chief. Every Indian was a chief. His name was Nakwadi, we called him Chief Knockwater. And every night he'd go down to PX, have a couple beers, and then come back and sit out in the barrack store, just about crying, telling the story of his terrible sadhood of his childhood, and was taken from the reservation and sent to these Indian schools away from his family. Oh, he cried, drank more beer, and got drunker, and he'd pass out. Some of the other Indians, when they got drunk, he passed out. Some of them got very violent, and one of them chased my friend around with a hand grenade once. It was very educational, but by and large, they were nice people, except when they got drunk. When they got drunk, maybe 25% got violent, the other 75% got very lachrymose. But whoever saw Indians? So that was a very educational experience. I didn't like it. I hated every minute of it. And I got in all kinds of trouble, actually. My first court-martial was there. It was a summary court-martial. That was a very honest thing, though. I took a long weekend and went back home. I took the Silver Meteor train north, and I got the first section back down. And no one told me the first section arrived after the second section. The second section got there first. So second section got there. First section got there late, and I missed reveille, and I was given a summary court-martial.
AWOL.
Summary court-martial. And I had to do extra company duty, that was all right, no big deal. But I had a little run-in with the company commander the second time. And that was the first time I got busted. I went, we all were made PFCs, private first class. And the orders came out that you will have your stripes sewn on by Wednesday at 1200 hours. And Wednesday at 1130 hours, I showed up at the supply room and said, supply sergeant, oh, give me those damn stripes. And the supply room was right behind the company headquarters. And I didn't see the company commander behind me. I said, give me those damn stripes. I don't want them. And his voice behind me said, soldier, you don't want those stripes? And I turned around, and there was the company commander. I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, fine, we'll take care of them. 2 hours later, they busted me from PFC to private without prejudice. Well, that meant I lost $4 a month.
Mm-hmm. What is private without prejudice mean?
Well, I was busted without prejudice. I was broken. I was demoted without prejudice.
Yeah.
I didn't do anything wrong. I just smart mouthed the company.
Big mouth.
Yeah. So it was a constant three-way war during the whole.
Did you get a second court-martial?
Yeah, I got a second court-martial. The first court-martial was the summary getting late. The second one was the stripes. And the third one, I was driving a 2.5-ton truck in Europe, and it was a very narrow road, and this 6-ton semi was being driven by this black guy, and he wasn't going to give any room in that road, so I turned the truck over and went off the side and turned the truck over and hit the car. I got busted again from PFC, $4 a month, didn't give a damn. But I got busted. So I got busted 3 times. It was a three-way war between me and the Germans and the Army. I never really got ahead till the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got rid of the Germans, and then I fixed the Army. But that's another story. Well, that's a later story. Anyway, this outfit went to England around Thanksgiving of 1944. We went over on the New Amsterdam. We were in a stateroom.
England in what month?
It was in November, right about Thanksgiving. The ship left from Boston without convoy. It was faster than the convoys and outrun submarines. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it was an uneventful trip, except it was seasick as hell for the first 2 days. Everybody was throwing up. It was a terrible situation. We were all in a stateroom. Yeah, we were 16 of us in one little stateroom. It was a god-awful mess. But after the second day, I cleared up, and we woke up one morning, looked out the porthole, and the ship, the engines weren't moving. And we were in Greenock, Scotland, which is not too far from Glasgow. And that was our introduction to the war. We went off the train, on a boat that evening, and took the train. It was all blacked out for the air raids and some of it. And we went down to Liverpool. Liverpool, we transferred to double-decker buses, but these Okies had never seen anything quite like that. They weren't going to go up in the upper level. They were going to fall over. And it was an education for them. And we lived in a suburb in houses. We were stationed in individual houses in a small hotel, very small hotel.
In Liverpool?
Across the river in a suburb called Wellesley. And we were there for about 4 weeks, and that was pretty nice. We didn't do very much. And then we got transferred to a camp near Chester, and, which wasn't too far down the Mersey River from there. And we then were training there. This was in November. And we were training there, and all of a sudden the Battle of the Bulge occurred, and they pulled a bunch of outfits out of reserve. We were not in reserve, but they pulled us out. Next thing I know, we're on trains and we do the channel crossing at night. And then we took trucks and convoy went up to Spa, Belgium, which where the Americans had gotten beaten on the north shoulder of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, the Germans were being pushed back again after their furthest penetrations up around Spa. And we were on the northern shoulder of the Bulge. We didn't have to move that stone, that was down the southern shoulder. But we were then attached to the U.S. 9th Army and then the British 3rd Army. And there were some cold, cold nights. Wet nights.
Do you remember the U.S. 9th commander?
I think General Hodges was
yes.
9th. Mm-hmm. You know, generals are really nursing. Like that William Toe cartoon. Willie is saying to Joe, who's underneath his pond and bridge, he says, "Hey, look, there goes General Washington." So Willie says from underneath his, "What am I supposed to do, pass and review?" That's about the way we felt, you know. Who ever saw a general? But anyway, that was a nasty situation. We were getting shot at with a kind of lift German mines that they laid behind in the retreat. And we were cold and wet constantly. I dug very good, not a fast digger. I dug a bigger foxhole in a very short period of time because the alternative was pretty grim. At least I'd dig, I'd get covered. At least get covered after my concealment.
You were now a so-called combat engineer,
right? Yeah. We worked as both as engineers, as mostly mine pickup. And we had to provide our own support, and we had our infantry. So we could do both and did both as we commanded them. It was a nasty, terrible time, the Battle of Bulge. It's interesting, there was another outfit started when ASTP broke up. And it was largely these discards in the ASTP program. And these kids really didn't make very good soldiers. As a matter of fact, they formed this division called the 106th. They were known as the Hungry and Sick. Terrible division. And they put that division across the Ardennes, holding the Ardennes. And that's the division that got hit. It just got decimated. It's got wiped out, as a matter of fact. Never was reconstituted. He got hit by von Rundstedt in the initial phases of the Battle of the Bulge, and that's why, that's one of the reasons the Battle of the Bulge really was an American defeat, because they put the wrong division at the wrong place. And the Germans knew about it. Now, it was also the right place to attack because it was a part of the Ardennes, which really wouldn't choose as the optimum place to run an army through. It was a difficult countryside. It was ravine, and wooded, and so they put the hungry and sick across that segment of the front, because they figured nothing would happen there. Mm-hmm. It was just made to order for von Rundstedt. So the 106th took some really heavy casualties. It's interesting, a number of my classmates from high school, from this academic high school, who had a career very similar to mine, or a military career, in quotation marks, found themselves, the AST people broken up, and they got sent to the 102nd. It was a terrible division, and they really asked for it. Very sad.
When the ASTP was broken up, I mean, your intentions were to
survive.
Well, basically to go to school.
If you survive, go to school.
Could you describe your feelings when you had heard of this?
Well, we were mad. We were discouraged. We were mad because the Army had told us we were going to do this thing. Suddenly the Army had decided we were going to do this, go through this program, and suddenly they broke their word to us, which was a bit of an education, to say the least.
And then
peace and education.
Your experiences in the various army camps, until you got to Europe, could you talk a little bit more about your interaction with other soldiers or?
Well, you know, soldiering was, you did your thing, you stayed out of people's ways, particularly if they wore stripes. And one time I heard some back talk from another private, and he sassed me, and it was some anti-Semitic content. So one night between the barracks, we had a fight, and we had a real battle, and I beat the hell out of him. And that was part of the game, and everybody sort of expected that. So you did your thing. And there was anti-Semitic stuff you'd see, so you'd hear it every so often. But that was part of life.
Were there any people from home that you knew?
There were actually there were two people. Well, one guy from home who I went to high school with, who was went along with me through all these steps. There was actually a second one, but he got sent off to different engineer, combat engineer battalion. He went back to the infantry with us, but then he got sent down to Oklahoma to the 1044th engineer battalion, combat engineer battalion. So we sort of lost track of him. But there was one fellow who went through high school with me, and went through high school. And that was it, just one guy I knew. He was in the medical company. I was in a combat engineer battalion, one of the regular ones with line companies. He was headquarters in the medical company.
How much time did you spend in England? Can you comment on
that? Well, the time we spent in England was, I'd say, relatively short, you see. We were there just before Thanksgiving, and we were there about three weeks. Oh my, I know what that is. Okay. Go back and
you're the one that's gotta be there.
Okay. Just go back a little bit, not much. Are you gonna play now? You running? Oh, I'm recording. Okay, fine. We were there, let's see. We were there about 3 weeks. The bulge started about December 20th, 1944. 21st, and we were there about the 23rd, 2 days before Christmas. 23rd, 24th. Because by about the 25th or so, or 26th, the Germans had gone as far as they were going to go in the Bulge, and they were hit their high point. And we came in just after they hit their high point on the northern flank of the Allied line into a town called Spa. There was a ammunition depot that was burning there, it was American ammunition depot that the Germans had set on fire and shelled, and there was ammunition going off, and we were detailed first to a crew which was given the job of putting fire out among this exploding ammunition depot. A lot of fun. And it went on from other things there, of course, as the Germans retreated, we picked up mines. We did picket duty, obviously, times. Particularly mine pull-up, a mine lifting operation. And about that time, I got bilateral pneumonia. I guess it was around New Year's or so. That was about January, I got evacuated to a field hospital and was there for about 3 weeks into February. And then I got mononucleosis. Nice place to get it. And spent another 3 weeks there. So here we are into February, early March, just beginning of March of 1945. It was a nice place to be. It was in a hospital which was outside of a Belgian town in the north called Tondres, which was near the near Maastricht, near the Dutch border. And after that, I got sent to a repo depot, a replacement depot, where I was supposed to rejoin my outfit. And for some reason, one day I missed a pickup that was supposed to take me back to the outfit. And so I stayed in the repo depot for a while, just bouncing around there, not doing anything. And then they pulled me out with a couple of other engineers. We rejoined a independent combat engineer battalion, and we went with the front, advancing front of the Allied forces when they went toward the Fulda Gap, F-U-L-D-A, which was an important defensive point landmark, defensive point in, oh, where would you describe it? Fulda Gap was actually near the division between East Germany and West Germany, in central Germany. And it was going through there that we were involved in the liberation of a concentration camp, which of course was another experience, of course, obviously, the likes of which we'd never seen in life before. We were involved in the liberation of a small camp, and it was not an important camp. It was called Ohrdruf, O-H-R-D-R-U-F, or something like that. And it was a feeder camp for Nordheim, something of that sort, a major camp which was further north. So it was not a very important camp, but they killed people there just as well, and they hung them there. And we came there, we liberated the camp. I got there very shortly after liberation. I can't say we did, the infantry was moving ahead of us. And it was just a shocking sort of thing. There were a lot of people shot, and shot just left there. The Germans killed a lot of them on the way out. And there was something else which happened there. There was a German guard that got left behind somehow. And when we got there, the living inmates that surround this guy were beating him to death, and we just go right ahead. We just let him beat him to death right there, and that was, you know, we were all very, very mad, upset about that. But there were certain things that had happened, of course, during the bulge that left us in a mood to do that. For example, there was the so-called Malmedy massacre, which we were all very aware of. And this was a SS outfit which had trapped this company of a field observer battalion and taken them prisoner and shot them down on the roadside in Malmedy. And this, of course, was SS sort of thing. And we were all aware of this, and the newspapers, obviously, the Stars and Stripes made us all aware of that. And at that time, it got very nasty. This was this guy, Skorzeny, was involved in the Battle of the Bulge. This is a Hungarian who Germans had used as a commando, and he was the one who liberated Mussolini when the Allies. Pakistani types were there, and they were wearing American uniforms, and they had people speaking English who were Germans in the SS. And so it was a very scary sort of thing, and you would be challenged all the time, and you'd better run over to what the ball scores were, because if you were challenged, the Germans couldn't really do much about that. And when we would pick up SS occasionally, we would be ordered to take them back to the cage and be back in 10 minutes. There was no way you could get back to the cage and be back in 10 minutes. And you were told to be back in 10 minutes. Well, there's only one thing to do, take them out of the woods and shoot them. That's indeed what we did do there. We did shoot German prisoners, but it was mostly SS. Not mostly, it was all the SS. If we caught any SS, we would shoot them right there. So we did that, but they were doing the same thing in this Normandy massacre, sort of.
Mm-hmm. I'm well aware of that one.
Yeah. Sort of lit that fire, yeah. And it really got very, very nasty.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing we saw in the concentration camp, that was a pretty natural thing for us to do. Let's go beat this guy to death, and it was fine for that.
At what point were you aware of what was going on with the Holocaust in Europe? As a soldier?
Never were really aware any more than other Americans were. To the same extent that we always heard these stories in the 30s, before the war, of Dachau. Everybody, all the Jewish community knew about Dachau in the United States. I wouldn't consider Dachau to be part of the Holocaust. That was really a political prisoner sort of thing, because there were people sent to Dachau who were not Jewish. A lot of people were not Jewish. They were largely political. So those were things that Dachau we knew about. But there's other things, obviously. Who knew about them? Who could believe them? Who knew about them? No one knew about them, really, in the United States. At least among the general population. I'm sure some of the political people knew about them. But that's a whole different story. I really know anything about that. All you know is what you read about. That's pretty undependable, I don't think. There's too many filters here. So, no, we didn't know anything of that sort. We never saw anything like that except as the liberation and the beating of the Germans unfolded and these death camps were unfolded. But to that extent, that's certainly nothing that any of us knew about except for the more notorious political type camps, death camps certainly, but not extermination camps.
You said that you had shot specifically Nazis.
SS.
Yeah.
What
did you know different about the SS than other German soldiers?
Well, we recognized uniforms.
No,
we recognized markings.
Why would the SS?
Well, because the SS were involved in all this dirty stuff, both in the, that was an SS Waffen Regiment. We knew who it was. We knew there were SS in the Malmedy massacre. And we also knew the SS were being dressed in American, were wearing American uniforms and trying to infiltrate lines, infiltrate the areas. And so if we ever caught any SS under the circumstances, particularly after the Normandy massacre, we'd take them out and shoot them.
Weren't the SS Himmler's direct command?
They were supposedly under the direct command of Himmler at that time. Anybody's guesses. Obviously, they were always a organization apart from the regular German army. Yes, no question about that. But that was Himmler's essentially private army.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing was, we knew that there were some people being pressed in the SS toward the end of the war, old people and youngsters. And as we got further away from the Malmedy massacre, less and less this thing sort of went on. But during the Bulls, and after the Malmedy massacre, for a number of weeks there, we were shooting SS people. Just that was it, period. And you knew who they were because they were SS insignia. Now they tried to rip them off, and then the people were missing insignia. Really got suspicious of that. Now, they still had different uniforms, but that sort of got fuzzy too. And as the SS became aware of this, they started changing uniform. But
were they not tattooed?
Not necessarily. Some were, but you couldn't depend on that. And each battalion had its own S2 or intelligence, and they were responsible for interrogating prisoners. We knew who we had pretty fast. The Germans were doing a lot of talking. They didn't just do name, rank, and serial number at that point in time. So we knew who we had, and as I say, when we got SS and we got some bona fide ones. We got orders to get them to the cage and be back in 10 minutes, which was obviously impossible. That was a direct order to do something with it, and we did it. That was a pretty desperate time at that particular point. It, I think, had eased off toward, by the time it got to March, in April, it pretty much settled down. And you take prisoners, and you would take prisoners, and the ordinary prisoners, you know, just like us, just their misfortune. Except there were times, I must say, when we had particularly nasty battles, and we got pinned down by 88, which were terrible artillery pieces that the Germans had. There were some battles in which there was some real nasty fighting in which there was fewer prisoners taken, let's say. That was unusual. There were some nasty firefights, so that did happen.
Dr. DeMint, I think we're at the end of the tape, and there are a lot of questions. Yeah. So I'm sure that when we come back, we'll come back with many questions.